We have a new slate of three speakers. We're going to start with Jan Nolan. She chairs the Nuclear Security Working Group and is a faculty member at the Elliott School of International Affairs of George Washington University. She has held senior staff positions in the Department of State and the U.S. Senate, and is a member of several Blue Ribbon commissions, including the White House Presidential Advisory Board on U.S. Arms and Technology Policy and the Secretary of Defense's Policy Board. Her talk today has a very intriguing title, Hooligans at the Gate, the Checkered History of Arms Control. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see Helen. Where the hell are you, Helen? I have to say that the only person in the universe that could have gotten most of us here on a Sunday morning is Helen Caldicott. So her energy. And there's someone else in the audience who I met yesterday who is writing a book about Helen as both a biography and as a microcosm of a theory of social change. And so I ran into Helen yesterday, and we talked about what a great movie this might make. And she suggested that Kate Blanchett should play her. So I think after I am in the category of people who thought it wise to scrap the speech after listening yesterday to a sort of unrelenting story of gloom and doom, and then a little more today. So I want to actually change the subject a little bit to talk. I will talk about gloomy stuff, but I want to talk about the politics of nuclear strategy. We haven't talked very much about the politics that prevent the change of narrative that have taken us to the moment where we are today, standing up here in a relatively depressed state of mind, because nothing really has changed. So I've been at this topic for more decades than I really want to count, watching the eternal resilience of the status quo around the paradigm that we call nuclear deterrence, which was discussed a little bit this morning or touched on in the context of the recent UN meeting on the humanitarian consequences. Why is it, or how is it, that we went, and particularly in this latest episode, from the Prague speech, the famous op-ed written by the Four Horsemen, the so-called Four Horsemen, Henry Kissinger, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, former Secretary of State Shultz, calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons in 2007 in an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, which has a reputation for having the most conservative op-eds. Helen, you missed my compliments. yeah, okay, I will. I'll be sure to repeat them. How we could go from this sort of seminal moment of the four probably most conservative and certainly most expert leaders of the defense establishment calling for the elimination of nuclear weapons, followed by the endorsement of that goal by the new and extremely popular president, to once again the reification of the deterrence paradigm, the triad, the sanctity of a triad, prompt counterforce, and all the other issues that we have talked about in the last day and a half. I'm changing the subject to talk about this because the theory of change and efforts to change how people think has to do with the correlation of forces on the ground, and even though there's been a lot of condemnation of Washington, you need people in Washington working for common objectives. Different tactics, common objectives, coalition building, and all kinds of things that have to do with power. And power isn't one of the topics that sits all that well, in my experience, inside the peace movement. The peace movement likes to talk about morality. It likes to talk about the high ground, talk about idealism. And often pragmatism and working with the levers of power is not the most popular topic, but it's extremely important. So let me just go through a few points about how we got from that high point in 2007 to where we are today, and then conclude with a few comments about where we might go from here. There was this moment that should still be with us of military logic, that nuclear weapons had outlived any utility that they could possibly have had, including for the large powers. In the logic of the Four Horsemen and the logic of Prague, there wasn't just a high-minded or moral condemnation of nuclear weapons. This was hardcore military logic. The United States, having achieved the preeminent conventional capability by orders of magnitude relative to any other country, spending as much on its own military budget as all countries combined behind it, the Four Horsemen saw in that situation, in the immediate post-Cold War, that the only thing that could threaten that preeminence would be small countries seeking to acquire unconventional weapons, so-called weapons of mass destruction, including and especially nuclear weapons. The only thing that could thwart the decisive advantage accorded to the force projection of the United States, in other words, would be a backlash against the perception of American superiority. And I would go further in defense, particularly of one of the members, Bill Perry, who understood that the perception of the lack of legitimacy of the use of force by the United States would be particularly provocative and encourage countries, other countries, to seek ways to thwart American power. Prophetic words, which began in work that I actually participated in working with Bill Perry in the early 1990s, under the rubric of cooperative security, there was a lot of optimism about a very different world after the end of the Cold War. But that said, there is still also a very strong military pragmatic component to this thinking. The revolution in military affairs, the reconnaissance strike complex, as the Soviets used to call American technological superiority, that Gorbachev recognized to be inherent inside the Strategic Defense Initiative, had pushed forward a new concept that could replace nuclear deterrence. Now, I'm talking to the sort of internal logic that had the opportunity to start shifting the thinking inside the Pentagon and inside the planning community, and had a great deal of support with the military. So what happened? What was interesting to watch, in terms of interesting in the sense of a slow-moving car accident, and by the way, this wasn't the first time. The nuclear freeze movement had, brought us to the, much closer to the brink of at least discussion of the repudiation of nuclear weapons. This was a moment where the centerpiece of power was talking about the growing disutility of nuclear weapons in American strategy as well as globally, as well as seeing a basic question about the legitimacy of the whole. But so what went wrong? There's in the literature of nuclear strategy a common understanding of the difference between so-called declaratory policy and operational policy. And that is just a way of formally recognizing that politicians, including presidents, will talk about what they would like to do, particularly in the nuclear area, and what happens at the operational level, meaning the planning level, where the people who are charged with putting together, in the nuclear case, what are warfighting plans that match targets, weapons to targets, targets to weapons, to actually execute these war plans in the event that deterrence fails. The disconnect between the declaratory and operational has only grown more pronounced, certainly in my lifetime and including in these recent years. So for all the welcoming and positive aspects of Global Zero, of the pledge for elimination, of the Prague speech, very little work was done to translate this rhetoric into actual alterations in the operational plans that underlie the concept and the realities of deterrence. Hans Christensen laid this out as graphically as you can imagine. So this reality is the result of political action, or inaction in this case, and it is part of a very long history of presidents trying to put their imprint on nuclear policy at the beginning of an administration and then turning to other things. I have written extensively about the sort of sad history of, I think, actually Hans touched on this, of what happens when the new candidate, the new president, commander-in-chief, is briefed on the content of the used to be called the Single Integrated Operational Plan, which is the large plan for the execution of nuclear weapons in war. Those sobering moments when the candidate is transformed into the commander-in-chief and realizes that they have the sole responsibility for deciding the fate of the Earth. It's a sobering moment because you realize how really embedded this highly resilient structure is, and how complicated it has become, and how much really out of the control of political authorities. Not because it's immutably that way, but because no president ever has spent the time to really to understand fully what's inside those plans or to change their direction. I mean, ironically, the one president who did at the moment of maximum opportunity was the first George Bush, because of the breakup of the Soviet Union. It was actually, of all people, Cheney who got the first briefing about the content of the PSYOP after the Soviet Union had broken up and realized that we had weapons targeted all over places that were becoming our new friends. A few, like 50 MX missiles over Poland, was considered a limited option. So, as had happened to President Clinton and has since happened to President Obama, you find the enduring disconnect between political aspiration and operational reality to serve as a drag on the system and leave you with the kind of highly resilient momentum of planning that leaves you with this legacy of intense dedication to the modernization of the triad, of new concepts, of smaller weapons potentially, all of which add up to the continued quest that goes back to the Manhattan Project of trying to think of how to harness the lethality of atomic and nuclear weapons for actual credible use on the battlefield. So let me just say a few things about the future and what I think we're up against, and I have not yet been said. Why are we back to kind of where we started with all the promise? And at the heart of this is the concept of deterrence. The deterrence concept is an extremely compelling narrative for capturing a form of public consensus, or at least acquiescence, that this crowd has not gotten. There is no compelling narrative coming out of out of this movement or about people who care about this issue. Deterrence is an infinitely open-ended concept. It is intrinsically sounds good. There is nothing, why would you not want to deter war? Underneath this concept, if a little deterrence is good, more is better. Why not? We actually have no operational definition of what deterrence is. What do you have to hold at risk? For what purpose? Under what circumstances? With what weapons? We have never had that debate as a nation. And so as such, and again, to go back to the political oversight, unless presidents and political authorities are paying attention, we really don't know what that deterrence concept means, but it's a great narrative, and it's a lot better narrative than, say, zero. At least we have to work on zero. It's not the best. This isn't kind of an invocation to the future of working with people who know something about communications, who know something about appealing to broader publics, who know something about speaking to Americans about these issues, so that we are not, and I blame all of us as the sort of nuclear experts, are not these unbelievably boring wonks who don't know how to speak to people who think that they have to be super expert in order to have a view about what the nuclear posture is. So let me conclude with that. And I know there are people around this room, and I was just talking to someone here who is involved in modern communications and, I think, narrative building and broadening audiences. It's, with unbelievable respect to all of you who've stayed in this room for 2 days, we strategic analysts are not doing you a favor by being such wonks. And so we need to work together to really change the structure and the content and the appeal of this dialogue. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. Some question of narrative is quite interesting. Of course, we all try to present in the most sort of straightforward, compelling, dynamic fashion possible. Certainly over the years, it's become clear that we have a lot of work to go with that. But I think there is, broad public support more for abolition than for, say, deterrence. And I think part of our job is to show direction with that and be as compelling as sort of the manipulative language inside the system that purports that this is actually what has the consensus. Absolutely. So very intriguing things to think about today.